This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
And a very good afternoon to you. Today, just before 1 o'clock, we're heading to Mushay, and because of the public holiday yesterday, two markets today, the cattle and the sheep, so we'll go through the yarding and the prices of both. Also today, you're going to meet Newdigate farmer Doug Giles, who has just set up a new steer group, partly to help young people compete in livestock handling competitions at the Royal Show. But it does sound like there's a little bit more behind his motivation.
Quite a few years ago, I went to Narrajinag College and there was a TO there. He changed my world for me because I wouldn't go in between two dairy cows at 16 years of age. I was absolutely petrified of cattle. Good place to look at cattle was on the top rail. And the TO's name's Ray Batt. If it wasn't for that man, I wouldn't be where I am now. Without Ray giving me the time of the day, I wouldn't have cattle studs.
Doug will tell you more about his story a little later in the hour. 12:06 here on the Country Hour. And we're also going to be putting the current wool price rally into some sort of perspective. Shortly you'll hear from one analyst who says it really reflects an industry in distress and contracting. But first, let's hear from Australian Wool Innovation, who says the huge increase in wool prices last week reflects what producers need to be paid to keep them in the industry. The Eastern Market Indicator rose more than 100 cents last week off the back of 9 consecutive weeks of price rises. Scott Carmody, Head of Domestic Operations with AWI, says it's just reward for those who've stuck it out.
It's nothing short of what, you know, wool growers deserve, in my opinion. We're definitely not at, you know, poverty levels, you know, prior to this, but we were just scraping through, and the input costs and everything that was going along making wool growing a little bit tough. I think what's happened in the last, you know, 10 to 12 weeks has given a reward for growers that have shown faith and sticking to a very, very, very good industry. I think this is just as a result of what we saw in China last week, where, you know, a huge gathering of over 400 people got together, and, you know, our traders from Australia were there in numbers, and they were very blunt to the Chinese. We have no stock to sell you, you know, and there's, you know, it's a week-to-week proposition on these small sales.
For some people, is this going to sort of pull them back from the cliff's edge, those people who are thinking, the wool job's not for me? Is this going to give them renewed confidence about the future?
I think it will give them some sort of boost in confidence that they are doing the right thing. I truly believe that this is the evidence that people need to be staying in wool and actually outside looking back at wool and saying, you know what, I might just give it a crack again or increase my numbers. That is what we're thinking at the moment.
And, Scott, in recent years I've done a lot of interviews with a wool theme and pretty much everyone has been pretty negative. How nice is it to finally have this positivity in the market?
I think it's good, and I'm very hopeful it'll continue. So I'm looking at the future, Angus. I mean, there's no crystal balls available, and obviously markets, doesn't matter what you're dealing in, there's bumps along the way, and there'll be retractions, there'll be bursts. But I think in general, I think it's a good space to be in. Wool growing is, combined with the meat portion of their enterprise on farm, I do believe it's one of the better industries you can be involved in.
In terms of the future, Scott, is this, you alluded to it, but is this a bit of a temporary blip, or is this more of a correction where the market's reached the level that buyers need to be paying?
Well, I think it's at that level. I mean, there's an EMI factor around $1,000 US. I know we don't get paid in US dollars here, but, you know, the markets around the world tend to use the US dollars as their base. So the 1,000 US cents mark for an EMI is around where most people in the trade are comfortable paying. We're about 40 or 50 cents US short of that basis at the moment. So, yes, I have confidence that this is real. The talks we had in China last week are all very confident that this price can be passed up in the immediate term because of the lack of supply through, or the lack of stocks or lack of inventory in the system at the moment.
Scott Carmody, he's Head of Domestic Operations with Australian Wool Innovation, and he was speaking to Angus Verley. 9 past 12. Well, not everyone in the industry shares that glass half full perspective. The driving force behind the recent rally in the wool market is a lack of supply rather than any increase in demand, and really reflects an industry in distress and contracting. That's the market analysis from Matt Dalgleish, director of episode3.net. Matt, talk us through that in a little more detail. What does the recent rally say about the current state of the wool industry?
I think it's a reaction to increasingly tighter and tighter supplies of wool, particularly in Australia, but more broadly as well. I think globally we've seen, you know, the trend's been down in terms of wool supply, and Australia being the major exporter of raw wool to the world, we're also in a situation of less and less wool supply, you know, a smaller wool flock. That's characterised, we've seen that progressively with the Australian Wool Forecasting Committee numbers over the last few years. We've seen that continuing. A number of sheep shorn has dropped, and the supply has dropped with it, and I think the price reaction is because it's getting so tight.
So are the current price increases that we've seen for wool over the last couple of months or so cause for celebration, or more a concern for a declining industry?
Yeah, I think I don't want to make light of the fact that higher pricing for the producer is a good thing, you know, always, but higher pricing doesn't necessarily mean that the prices are rising ahead of costs. And I think the main underlying reason why we're seeing this price increase for wool in Australia is because the industry is continuing to contract significantly, and the amount of wool available is continuing to go down. So, yeah, that to me is a signal of an industry in distress and contracting, rather than a huge growth in demand for wool somehow globally that's underpinning these stronger prices. If it was that, I'd say it's much stronger and much more favourable scenario, but I don't think it is that.
Well, let's have a look back and try and put what we're seeing today into some sort of perspective. Let's look back at previous rallies on the wool market and look at the driving factors there compared to what we're seeing today, Matt.
Yep. And we saw a bit of a fine wool rally in the most recent kind of wet spell back in 21 through to 23. The fine wool market rallied a bit then, but I think a proper, more broad-based rally would be back to the 2018 period, and that's when we saw not just fine wool, but also some of the medium wool and even the coarse wool rallied up to over, you know, I think it got up to about $12 or $13 back then for your kind of 28 micron type wool. Yeah, so in that 2018 rally was, I would characterise that as being, there was also global supply and Australian supply was in a downward momentum in terms of trend, but I think what was underpinning a lot of that rally too was an increase in demand through that time. And that's why I think we saw that across the board kind of strength across all microns. You know, we had the Chinese, who traditionally were always a purchaser of raw wool, and then they were processing and sending product to the final destination markets in North America and Europe and the like. But through that kind of mid-2000s to the late teens in the 2000s, the Chinese started to also consume wool product as a final product within China as well. So they weren't just a transfer of raw wool and sending it back out again. They were actually consuming some of the product finally as well. There was a lift in demand for activewear, if you remember. That became quite popular. So there was quite a few trends there that were supporting growth in wool demand across the globe, different parts of the globe. And I think that was what was really underpinning that rally, whereas the current price strength we're seeing now is, I think, purely a reaction to that very tight supply.
So that's the missing element. There's no increase in demand. It's just the dwindling supplies of wool.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the Chinese economy is hanging in there, but it's not, I wouldn't describe the Chinese economy as being incredibly robust at the moment in terms of their growth levels. And we know from historic modelling of what drives wool prices, some of the key factors that drive it. One is obviously supply is a big factor, but the other main driver of wool price movement is global demand for wool product. And if you look at some of those key indicators, you know, the North American economies, the US economy, it's been resilient, but there are signs that that economy is faltering. You know, high levels of credit card default, increased people in the US that are more people working in more than one job. So that's been a big rise in secondary job holders. The labour market in the US has been weakening through 2025. So there's all these signals there that suggest the US economy is slowing and potentially teetering on a move to recession, with some of the Trump-based tariff policies hurting the economy and that's not helping. You've got the UK and Europe still grappling, like Australia grappled with that high cost of living scenario we went through post-COVID, that inflationary spiral we saw in a lot of Western economies, that's still working its way through. So there's fairly low levels of growth in Europe as well, and low levels of consumer confidence. So in some fairly key markets, there's not enough really to get the demand for a product like wool firing. And I think that's part of the reason why we're seeing that very low levels of demand for the product globally.
So the benchmark Eastern Market Indicator was up 109 cents to finish the week last week on 1,453 cents a kilo clean. Is that something to be excited about at this point?
Oh, it's better to see it there than at 1,200 cents, absolutely. But I mean, if you go back to that 2018 rally, the Eastern Market Indicator went above $20 a kilo, or your 2,000 cents. So we're still a fair way away from that real, what I call that bull period. And I would suggest too that it's good to see that the price movement more favourable to the producer, absolutely. But I think when you think of what we've seen in terms of rise of costs of shearing, costs of fuel, costs of fertiliser, there's lots of inputs to the wool sector that have gone up in price as well. And so I'd be really looking to see, from a margin perspective, has the increase in the wool price, broadly speaking, has it gone up enough to compensate the farmer for all of the other higher costs that they're having to face to produce the wool?
How do you think wool growers would be assessing the current situation? Because there's a lot of talk about, this is great reward for those who've stuck in the industry, and it's even some of those who've got out or thinking about getting out might be changing their mind based on what we've seen over the last couple of months.
What's the old saying, Belinda? One swallow doesn't make a spring. I think a bit of a price rise for a few months doesn't necessarily make a huge fundamental shift to a market. When you look at the broader picture of global supply and demand, the only reason I think the wool prices are going up is because the supply is increasingly tighter. It's not because of an underlying growth in demand, unfortunately. Whereas if you look at other products within the same animal space, if you look at the prospects into the future for sheep meat as an exported product, the demand outlook for that is incredibly robust out to the next decade or more. And at the same time as there's growing demand, the supply situation is that of a tight supply scenario. So from that perspective, that's an ideal kind of picture for the producer, because you've got rising prices, rising demand, and supply being limited. That to me paints a picture of an industry that's really a positive one to get into for longer term, whereas the picture in the wool space is not really one of surging demand for the product, and it's a picture of a global sector that's becoming more and more niche and more marginalised because of that tightness of people getting out and supply not being available. It's an industry in decline rather than an industry that's growing. And that's why the prices are going up, to try and attract people back into it. But, like I said, are they rising off to compensate for expenses of producing wool? And also, what's the longer-term prospect for that market? Is it a market that shows really good future prospects beyond the next few months or the next few years? And I'd argue that at the moment, that's not the picture I'm seeing.
Matt, great to talk to you. Thank you.
Cheers, Belinda.
Matt Dalgleish, he's the director of episode3.net. What do you make of that analysis? Do you agree or not? Are you a glass half full or glass half empty perspective when it comes to the wool market now and going forward? Let me know on the text 0448 922 604, 19 past 12. Well, meanwhile, an increasing number of WA farmers are considering feedlotting sheep. That's according to Jared Roney. He's a lot feeder from Ballarat in Victoria's Central Highlands, who's hosting some workshops in WA to help farmers apply for the grants on offer through the transition package out of the live sheep trade by sea. He says there are millions of dollars up for grabs, and he'd like to see most of it end up in farmers' pockets.
Right now, there's $20 million coming out, And then in the following 12 months' time, there's another $20 million for applicants. I'd rather see it all dedicated to the breeding farms, but it does go to capacity for the abattoirs to apply as well.
Do you think, given that there is money on the table, more farmers are going to consider lot feeding?
That's right. And I suppose part of the money on the table is that dollar for dollar investment. So that means that, let's say, $100,000 investment goes in, and if your application's successful, the government will pay for half of that. So based on that, I think there's been no better time ever to look at doing the numbers on feedlotting.
Now, you're touring around Western Australia. You've spoken to a couple of hundred farmers. You're going to speak to a couple of hundred more. Are these farmers, are they already established in lot feeding, or are some of them looking to do it for the first time?
Yeah, great question. So, yeah, part of the discussion with farmers at the start of a group, we'll talk about how many have been, you know, feedlotting in the last, you know, somewhat in the last 5 years. And I'd say 80% have to some degree, you know, held lambs, finished lambs. So majority of the interest is from farmers that have done it to some degree and maybe want to expand.
To what extent are they looking to expand? I mean, they're looking to go all out, or just something that's, I suppose, a little bit more permanent than what they've already had?
Well, I would say it ranges, but coming from, you know, being based over east near Ballarat in Victoria, the numbers going forward and the change to larger carcass weight and export markets taking heavier and heavier animals and those markets being so lucrative, I think it's really changing the way of people thinking about turning off a 24-kilogram carcass compared to now thinking more towards a 32-kilogram carcass, adding that capacity into the WA market.
So how difficult is it to make that transition towards growing out a heavier sheep?
I don't want to, like, dismiss any complexities with it, but for myself, you know, I've got 7,000 breeding ewes on a farm near Ballarat, and I think that running the feedlot is far simpler than running a breeding enterprise. So once we get the water right, we've got the ration right, we've got the environment right, it's just replicating the same thing every day, checking animals, tipping out water troughs. For me, I don't think it's very complicated. Once an animal's inducted in the feedlot, and the induction side of things can be a bit, you know, labour intensive or challenging, once they're in there, there's no reason to take them away before export weight, I don't think.
It essentially feels like you can go all in, or you can just dip your toe in, really. It depends.
That's right. And part of it becomes to investment risk management. Let's say you try it, you don't want to do it in 2 or 3 years' time, and you've got that infrastructure. Can we liquidise that and get, you know, our money back? And I suppose when the government's putting in dollar for dollar, the risks for farmers is extremely low if the government's already paid for half.
Victorian lot feeder and founder of Advantage Feeders, Gerard Roney, speaking to Tara de Landgraft. And Gerard does say that the grant application process is complex, so you do need to do your homework before you get started. 23 past 12.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
We'll check the news headlines shortly for you. First, though, Australia's obesity crisis is worsening, and experts say an overconsumption of ultra-processed foods is to blame. So is it time for a junk food tax? As Jane McNaughton explains, a recent UNICEF report shows more children across the globe are likely to be malnourished and overweight rather than too thin.
Health experts and farmers are calling for a tax on ultra-processed foods. As a new report has found, obesity now exceeds thinness as the leading cause of malnutrition among school-aged children globally. The UNICEF report found malnourishment is affecting 1 in 10 or 188 million school-aged children and adolescents, placing them at risk of life-threatening disease. The report recommends urgent implementation of comprehensive mandatory policies to improve children's food environments, including labelling, marketing restrictions, and food taxes and subsidies.
The interesting thing about malnutrition isn't just that you're not getting enough food intake. Malnutrition is about not getting the correct nutrients, minerals, vitamins, fibre in your diet.
That's nutritional psychiatry researcher Dr. Megan Lee with Bond University. She's one in a growing cohort of health professionals calling for a tax on ultra-processed foods.
When we eat ultra-processed foods, which are very lacking in fibre, vitamins, minerals and antioxidants, it's like eating nothing.
Ultra-processed foods and beverages are formulated in factories, primarily made from refined ingredients and additives with little to no whole foods. Junk foods like chicken nuggets, hot dogs, lollies and soft drinks are high in calories, have added sugars, refined starches, salt and unhealthy fats. They're designed to be convenient and highly palatable, but provide little to no nutritional benefits.
Because we have been assaulting our taste buds with this hyper-sweet, hyper-salty, food-like substances for decades, it takes the taste buds in our system a while to recalibrate to fresh whole foods. So if you're eating a very high ultra-processed food diet, it'll take 2 months for your taste buds to recalibrate. So when you do eat healthy foods at the beginning, they taste bland and boring. So most people are like, oh, fruit, veg, nuts, seeds, whole grains, these things are boring and bland. I'm not spending the rest of my life eating foods that are boring to me. When they don't realize that after, say, 2 months or 68 days of eating those foods, your taste buds realign with healthier foods and then they start tasting amazing and that these foods taste great. And then when you have a bottle of Coke or a pastry or a cake, they taste too sweet.
In high-income countries, including Australia, nearly half of the average person's diet is made up of ultra-processed foods. The UNICEF report says junk food is increasingly replacing fruits, vegetables and protein at a time when nutrition plays a critical role in children's growth, cognitive development and mental health. In Australia in 2022, over a quarter of children were overweight or obese, according to the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare. This represents approximately 1.3 million children and adolescents, a 20% increase since 1995. Two-thirds of adults were also overweight or obese.
Individuals are stuck in a system where we are advertised ultra-processed foods every day. We've been eating ultra-processed foods for decades now, and it's a little bit trickier for the individual to change these systems because, number one, there is a cost of living crisis at the moment, and ultra-processed foods, unfortunately, are cheaper than their whole food comparators. We also are working more. So mum and dad will both be working jobs, maybe two jobs, to put food on the table. And so making things from scratch and growing our own food and getting foods from the farmers' markets, we haven't got the time to do that anymore. So we are going and picking up things very quick and very convenient.
So how would a tax on junk food work?
Tax on ultra-processed foods is a good idea, but not because we want to make food more expensive and putting people in food insecurity situations. It's more like putting a tax on ultra-processed foods and funneling that money into making healthier foods cheaper. And the way that we do that is by giving the money to the farmers.
Australians not eating enough fresh foods is one reason a new report by AusVeg has found 2 in 5 vegetable growers are currently considering leaving the industry in the next 12 months. Jolyon Burnett is chair of the National Farmers Federation Horticulture Council. He says it's hard to compete with junk food as horticulture battles with high input costs such as fertiliser, fuel and electricity.
We do have to be careful about introducing new taxes. Agriculture particularly, and my sector, horticulture, suffers terribly from a mountain of regulation and compliance that all adds cost and complexity to our business. So if something can encourage people, consumers, to look more carefully at what they're consuming and what they're eating, and perhaps help tip the balance towards healthy, fresh, nutritious fruit, vegetables and nuts, then, you know, it's definitely worth a look. One of the problems is that ultra-processed food can be produced extremely cheaply. And the volume that it's produced in and the lack of often high labour content, the lack of high quality fresh ingredients, all these things mean that it can be put on the supermarket shelves extremely cheaply. We are in danger of this terrible downward spiral where the very sort of eating behaviours we want to encourage are being penalised and being made harder, and the eating behaviours we want to discourage are becoming cheaper and easier. So something that halts that, something that reintroduces a more positive price differential, absolutely is worthy of good investment. And I agree that if that tax generates revenue, then that revenue should 100% be spent on increasing the consumption of fresh produce. Now, that may be subsidising imports. It may be working to reduce the regulatory and compliance burden, or it may be used in well-targeted and well-understood public health campaigns.
Chair of the National Farmers Federation Horticulture Council, Jolyon Burnett, speaking to Jane McNaughton about calls for a junk food tax. At this stage, the federal government is not considering a junk food tax. It says to support healthy food choices, fruit, vegetables and other core foods are exempt from GST. The government is also working with the food industry to reduce the amount of sodium, sugar and saturated fat across a range of products through the Healthy Food Partnership Reformulation Program. And the government has also committed $3.5 million to develop Feeding Australia. The aim of that new national food security strategy is to provide a long-term whole-of-system plan to boost the productivity, resilience and security of our national food system. You can read more about it. It's online for you now. Just search the ABC Rural homepage. 29 to 1. Jonathan Beale is here with an update from the newsroom.
Thanks, Belinda. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has welcomed the US President's proposal for ending the war in Gaza. The peace plan would involve returning Israeli hostages and Palestinian prisoners and an end to Hamas's rule in Gaza. Donald Trump would then assume control of the so-called Board of Peace that would govern Gaza after Israeli troops withdraw. If Hamas does not agree, Mr. Trump says Israel would have his support to finish the job of destroying the threat of Hamas. A 32-year-old man has pleaded guilty in the Perth Magistrates Court to charges related to the theft of a rideshare vehicle. In June, Chan Nat Din pulled a rideshare driver from his vehicle in Perth CBD and drove off. He was arrested after a pursuit which ended when he crashed into an embankment. Din pleaded guilty to charges including stealing a motor vehicle, dangerous driving and possession of methamphetamine. He's due to be sentenced in January. And the Australian College of Nursing says new prescription laws are a lifeline for regional and remote communities. From today, tens of thousands of nurses are eligible to complete extra training to prescribe medications. The move is designed to address critical shortages in the primary healthcare workforce. More news, Belinda, at 1 o'clock.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. 28 to 1 here on the Country Hour. Just a moment ago, we were talking about whether or not it's time for a junk food tax, with Australia's obesity crisis worsening and some of the experts saying an overconsumption of ultra-processed foods is to blame. This on the text from Jim, who says everyone should see the documentary called What Are We Really Eating? It was on SBS about a year ago and exposes major food questions and quality. All school students should have a look at it. Thank you for that, Jim. You can probably watch it back on SBS on their playback service if you're looking for it. What Are We Really Eating is the tip from Jim. Thank you for that. Be part of the conversation on the text 0448 922 604. Shortly, we're going to meet Doug Giles. He's from Newdigate. He's set up a new steer group, and it's partly to help young people compete in livestock handling competitions at the Royal Show, which is on right now, and we'll take you there shortly. First to the Bureau of Meteorology, Angeline Prasad with you this afternoon. And how's it looking across the Southwest Land Division?
Good afternoon, Belle. It's pretty quiet over the next couple of days. We're looking at settled weather conditions under a ridge of high pressure. We have got a weak front that's going to brush past the south coast later today into tomorrow. So that is going to bring in some very light showers or drizzle areas to the southern coastal districts, including parts of the Great Southern. But I'm not expecting much in the rain gauge, less than a millimeter sort of through those areas tonight into tomorrow. In the mornings, we're still going to see areas of fog across inland parts of the Southwest Land Division. And we're seeing overnight temperatures still falling down to single digits, but they're generally staying above that 3 to 4 degrees sort of threshold for frost. Once the front moves through, we'll go under a ridge of high pressure again. So it's possible on Thursday morning we might see some very isolated patchy frost here and there, because we'll see some areas fall to that 3 degrees, 2 to 3 degrees. But generally, we're seeing an easing trend in frost this week. On Thursday, we'll see the West Coast trough return. So that is going to drag in a bit of heat from further up north. So we'll see daytime temperatures reach the low 30s through parts of the central west, the central wheat belt, eastern parts of the Great Southern and southeast coastal. And that heat will stick around for a couple of days through those areas into Friday. But it doesn't last beyond that. We'll see that heat contracting off to the east. The next cold front couples with a cloud band over the weekend, so we could see some good falls across the Southwest Land Division. It's a bit unclear. There's still some uncertainty how much rainfall we'll see, but we could potentially see 5 to 10 millimetres, and some areas could see up 10 to 20 millimetres. Still early days yet, and we'll have better rainfall figures for you later in the week.
And Ange, how's it looking across northern and eastern parts?
It's quite across the north and east as well. The heat is building across the north, so we're seeing daytime temperatures reach the high 30s to low 40s. We'll start to see one or two showers and the odd thunderstorm across the northern Kimberley, extending across the east to the eastern Kimberley later in the week. But elsewhere, it's going to be pretty quiet until we see that cloud band develop towards the end of the week. So most likely from Friday night into the weekend, we'll see this cloud band develop in relation or couple or in association with the cold front. So we could see those widespread showers that I've talked about for the Southwest Land Division spread into the Gascoyne, the Goldfields, the Eucla, the southern interior, and also the far western Pilbara.
Thanks for those details, Ange. Appreciate that. 24 to 1 here on the Country Hour. And in the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning, not much rain across Western Australia. The top figures in the southwest, Pemberton had 10 and Walpole Forestry had 13, but that was over 3 days. And then in the southern coastal region, Esperance Aero had just 2 and Munglinup also 2 in the gauge. Between now and the news at 1, we're head to Mouchet just before 1, going through the details of the yarding of the cattle and the sheep markets and all the prices for you. First, though, a Newdigate stud breeder has started a new steer group to try and help young people learn livestock handling skills. Doug Giles wants to give the next generation the opportunity to compete at the top level at the Royal Show, which is currently underway here in Perth. But he says it's also about trying to make sure more and more young people realise they can have a full career in livestock.
We've worked at the cattle handling camp down at Brunswick for 2 years as a leader in the groups there, and we noticed that there's some really good young people, not just students, there's young people in the workforce down there that are really good at working livestock and are really good at handling show cattle and stud cattle. And once we leave that handling camp, unless the stud gets hold of them, they're not there until 12 months later when that camp happens again. And there's some really good people there that I think we're losing in the industry, and it's our opportunity to give something to these kids so that the industry can actually see them and hopefully help them in the show circuit.
Where are these kids from? Are they coming from ag colleges? Where are they from?
They're from everywhere. Like at that Brunswick handling camp that they run, and that is an awesome setup. They have young people coming all the way from above Geraldton, from right down south, right down the southwest coast, round to Albany, as far out to Esperance, and I think we actually had a couple come in from out Kalgoorlie way at that camp. So it's just a massive area of people that all combine together.
Why don't they have other opportunities throughout the year?
Unfortunately, due to policy changes and so forth, a lot of the colleges that used to support the younger people to give them the other opportunity of coming up to Perth, the policy changes in school, so obviously they can't get the opportunity to come up here with cattle. So the easiest way is to just drop out of that group. So they don't have the opportunity, so there's nowhere for them to go.
So that's where you come in this year. So tell me a little bit about your background, why you found yourself in this position.
Quite a few years ago, I went to Narrajinag College, and there was a TO there that he changed my world for me, because I wouldn't go in between two dairy cows at 16 years of age. I was absolutely petrified of cattle. Good place to look at cattle was on the top rail. And the TO's name's Ray Batt. I owe him everything. If it wasn't for him... Sorry. If it wasn't for that man, I wouldn't be where I am now. Without Ray giving me the time of the day, I wouldn't have cattle studs. Probably make my parents a lot happier and not having to spend so much time with cattle that I have. I wouldn't have cattle studs. I wouldn't have a property down south that I've helped set up for my family for the future. And after that, being in the industry from Ray, another fella called Paul Williams got hold of me and we started driving with him, and he taught me how to handle stud livestock on a trucking business. So without Ray, the rest of the candles don't line up for me. And Ray, out of his own pocket, he brought my first set of moleskins for me to come compete at the Royal Show, because I wasn't in the cattle group. I missed out for other reasons, and he thought I might have the opportunity. So he brought me my first pair of moleskins. I think I painted one side of his house, and that was payment for me. So he gave me the opportunity to come up here, and I just want to return that to, because so many colleges now are dropping off, and those kids aren't getting the opportunity that I had. And I've got a magnificent group of people around me, like the three families that donated cattle for me to feed and set up and bring up here. And I didn't do the best job I could have done this year. We had a couple of setbacks in the program, and their cattle looked fairly good. I was pretty proud on how they looked. They handled beautifully, and that was our main one. But I could have done a better job. The cattle could have been prepared a little bit better. Probably a little bit busy on the farm and trying to do too big a team in the first go was probably a setback for us. But without those guys, like, and I'll mention them, there's Rayview Park, Jared Carroll's family, John Meal, his daughter's come through the system. So he gave me two steers to feed up. Another fella, he had some really good steers, but I brought them off him to take the pressure off him so he wasn't involved. And then you've got Nutrien came on board when they heard what I was doing, and they've helped pay some of the costs, because it's quite a big outlay. Like, we have lost money a little bit. If it was an independent setup, we would not have gone around today properly.
Yeah, wow, it sounds like a mammoth effort. So just for me, Doug, just paint a picture. How many heifers have you brought up this year, and how many kids have you brought that wouldn't have got that opportunity to be here otherwise?
So we brought a team of 14 steers, and then we had a team of four steers come out of Esperance from a young girl that she did most of her work, and we just swung across to help them. And then another lady that was really helpful with Danny, she got hold of three more steers from Kurt Wise, so at South End Murray Grey. So all up, I think that there was 19 in that group, plus we also brought six stud animals up.
So in the future, how do you ensure that this continues to happen? Like, is it you that just has to keep each year providing these steers so that young generations have the opportunity to do it up here, or are you hoping other people get on board?
For my wealth and health for my wife, I hope other people get on board and help us. And we have had people come up and say, hey, you've bitten off too much, you can chew, you've done a pretty good job, but how about next year I feed five steers and someone else does another five steers, but we all meet up at Perth Forum. And that'd take the pressure off. Like, it's a pretty big deal. And like, it's pretty easy for me to open my mouth and say, this is how we're going to make it. But I'm pretty lucky. Like, Danny, my wife, she's had to do a fair bit. Like, on Saturday, probably pushed my luck a bit with her. Like, she was under a fair bit of pressure because we're all so busy. But you got Danny, Rachel Williams, Crystal Henderson, Bianca Ransom. They're the ones that have really helped me come along. They all came out for a day and a half at home to help us finish training the cattle.
And just to finish off, Doug, what would your message be to the wider community to, you know, kind of show how important this is to make sure there's a space for young people to be able to involve in steer competitions?
Not just steer competitions. All industries are getting older. We don't have the young generation coming through. We've got to support our younger generation to come through. This is the only way I could do it. And in saying that, that some of the young people have been with us this last 3 or 4 days. They were meant to go home yesterday. They're still in the cattle lanes. A couple of other studs have come and said, oh, I remember that person. Can I grab that one? Can I grab this one? And they've been asked to stay. So I think at the moment we still have 4 of them walking around helping other people. So to me, that's a bit of a win. And that's all we're trying to do, is keep the younger generation coming in, keeping them involved, keeping the opportunity. Like one of the young fellas working for me up here at the moment, I'm hoping in next year when he finishes college that, if I'm not too slow, I'll have the opportunity to employ them and bring them home and help us keep going forward.
Mm, yeah, because you're from out at Newdigate?
Yeah, out at Newdigate. We've got 5,500 hectares out there.
How's your year been going out there? Because obviously you're pretty busy with this, getting this off the ground. So how's the rest of the farm going?
Hopefully it's still surviving while I'm up here. No, we had a pretty hard start, but I think we've had a fairly good soft season at the moment. It's finishing pretty well for us. Here, a bit of frost around for some people. We might know the true story until we get into harvest, but at the moment it's looking pretty good. We've got a fairly good hay season, so it's a good start for someone that runs a lot of livestock.
Mm, yeah, well, good luck for the rest of the show, and when do you head back?
Yeah, we'll load up tomorrow morning and start heading off, yeah.
Yep. Well, Doug, thanks so much for chatting to us on the Country Hour, and good luck.
Cheers, thank you.
Doug Giles, who runs 3 cattle studs near Newdigate, about 400 kilometres southeast of Perth. He was talking to Kate Forrester at the Perth Royal Show. So Doug is doing his bit. I wonder if you or someone else you know in the community is doing their bit as far as encouraging young people, the next generation, to consider a career in agriculture. Let me know if there's someone that comes to mind immediately. The text is 0448 922 604. And in news just in, the Reserve Bank has left interest rates on hold at 3.6%, having cut them at its previous meeting in August. The RBA has cut interest rates 3 times this year, from a peak of 4.35% prior to February's board meeting. Just repeating, the Reserve Bank has left interest rates on hold at 3.6%. 14 minutes to 1 o'clock. An Indigenous Kimberley Ranger group has just taken out a top land care award for using Right Way Fire to care for country. It involves carefully controlled burns during cooler months to prevent larger, more destructive fires later in the season. This is now common practice for the Dampier Peninsula Fire Working Group involving Nyulnyul Rangers north of Broome. Head Ranger Preston Cox says the Right Way Fire method has been passed down through generations of traditional owners.
The whole point is pretty much, I guess, regeneration. So if you do it at the right time, the whole country can, I guess, refresh itself, and it's better for the animals and plants as well. So yeah.
And how is it different from other types of burning, like back burning, for instance?
Well, back burning, I think, is just off the top of my head. It's more like if you're kind of fighting a fire. So if there's a bad fire coming into a certain like a property or something, and you need to do a back burn, that's what it is. It's sort of stopping wildfires from, I guess, impacting wildlife or mainly people and infrastructures and stuff. Yeah. So back burning is more like, I guess, protective.
And Right Way Fire is more proactive.
Yeah, so the Right Way Fire is pretty much the step before that, so you don't have to get to the point where you have to do backburns. So, yeah, it's kind of this, I guess, the, what's the word, prevention of that.
Where does the knowledge come from when it comes to Right Way Fire? How do you know when and where to burn?
I think it's just been passed down. I know it's just been passed down from generation to generation, so we know the right time. Like for myself, personally, my grandfather, we got a block just outside of Beagle Bay, and we used to run around the community like probably May, June, and just throw matches around. And yeah, I knew that was the right time. So yeah, pretty much something that's been passed down through, I guess, countless generations of the right time. So yeah.
For someone, including myself, who hasn't seen this in action, can you explain what you actually do when you light Right Way Fires?
So like with us on the peninsula, like same with Badi Jawi as well, we're just north of us, the ranges up there, we sort of work from pretty much mid-May roughly through to August if need be. So pretty much within that period, it's just pretty much going out and doing as much burning as we can to during the cool, I guess, the cooler seasons where we are. And that sort of helps with the putting out of the fire. So we know it's a good burn when we go and do a burn, when we go back the next day or maybe 3 years later, you can already see green growth already sort of coming up back. Whereas if it's later in the year, like say August to thing, you can kind of see that it is a huge impact and it does not look nice.
And can you talk a bit more about the changes that you notice on the land right after Right Way Fire has gone through?
Yeah, like you can pretty much see it. Well, the whole when this first started in 2015, I really remember that there was a huge fire that went through the whole Middle Peninsula, which we are, and it burned through a couple of parcel properties. One of the properties had to get evacuated and jumped the road towards the west side and back towards Broome. So it's a pretty big fire. And yeah, I drove to Broome a few days later, and yeah, you could just see that, I guess, with a good decimation. So it's just all black and brown, not a single green leaf or a single thread of green grass, which is, being indigenous, it kind of brought a tear to my eye. And since then, with this fire that we have been doing, and then we, like I say, the Dampier Peninsula Fire Working Group was made not long after. And then, yeah, you can see the difference in the data and the landscape. So, you know, you still got trees that are still green. Grass is pretty much growing 2 days later. So it's, yeah, huge difference.
I can tell this means a lot to you. How do you feel about doing this kind of work and being out on country, doing things the old way?
I think it's, well, like I say, it's like what I mentioned earlier, it's been passed down, but I think it's just, I guess the pride, you know, you're being indigenous, we are carrying on what our ancestors have been doing for years, and I think that gives us a bit of, you know, that pride as well. So, you know, we're looking after our country the way they did. I mean, it's in a sort of modern day method, but it's the same goal, I guess.
Head of the Nyulnyul Rangers, Preston Cox, speaking to Jess Baker after their Dampier Peninsula Fire Working Group took out the First Nations Landcare Collaboration Award at the 2025 National Landcare Awards that were on last week. The group is made up of the Nyulnyul Rangers as well as representatives from the Kimberley Land Council, Rangelands, NRM, Environs Kimberley and the Department of Fire and Emergency Services, WA. 9 minutes to 1 o'clock. Chicken growers say an ABARES interim report on their industry has identified what they've known for a long time, that the industry isn't working properly. David Innell is the CEO of the Australian Chicken Growers Council. He says it's significant that the report very early on found systemic market failure has been caused by a power imbalance between processors and the growers.
It's very strong language sort of in terms of economics and market power balance. We were very pleased to see that because that's certainly what we're hearing from growers. They're saying that the industry issues are largely systemic and being experienced by a large proportion of contract growers. And importantly, what ABARES has said is that without change, there may be unnecessary adjustment in the chicken meat industry, which has the capacity to affect supply and consumer prices.
They also said in the report that there's a very different view from the processing sector, that they thought that the growers were happy, that things are functioning pretty smoothly.
Yeah, the report does say that, and we look forward to any of those integrated producers who may wish to come into the media and just discuss that a little further. But the report does highlight that, and maybe that's one of the challenges around the culture of the sector, because the report also does have, which is actually not so common in reports of this nature, to have a dedicated section around industry culture where it unpacks that a little further. And that's why
What are they saying about culture? What do they think is wrong there?
It's mostly around the power imbalance, and also the report also around culture talks about producers or growers and their fear to argue or demand changes to the contracts, which is also a key part to this. Is any contract in a business is a willing buyer and a willing seller, and what we really want to see is a move away from, as the report indicates, take it or leave it contracts, which is what growers have reported is a situation they find themselves in at renewal, and often at renewal with less favourable terms and conditions. So we'd like to see that repaired as soon as possible.
What about contracts? Are you aware of any concerns about contracts and what could be changed in that area?
I'm most certainly hearing from growers with, when it comes to renewal time, the grow fee for some has barely changed compared to the previous renewal time. And even just looking at CPI and cost of doing business, cost of inputs, just running any business in Australia from, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years ago clearly is more expensive and more complicated now, typically higher regulatory burden, red tape, is something that growers do not see largely recognised in how they're paid. So that's also a key component to the type of legislative sort of transparency that we'd like to see with a prescribed mandatory code of conduct.
David Innell, he's the CEO of the Australian Chicken Growers Council. He was speaking to David Claughton. 6 minutes to one. A mining company in the southwest has started a contract with Tyre Cycle to recycle end-of-life conveyor belts that would have otherwise gone to landfill. The belts from Alcoa's mine sites will be recycled into a bitumen additive for roads. Alcoa Regional Environmental Manager for Sustainability, Jody Gould, says it's an important step towards reducing mine waste.
Yeah, over the next couple of months, we're starting with aiming to deliver 32 kilometres of conveyor belt that has obviously reached its end of life. And then in time, we'll move to an as-needs basis so that each time we replace a section of the belt, we can deliver them directly to Tyre Cycle in the East Rockingham facility.
So you've already been recycling truck tyres, mining truck tyres. Now you're obviously onto the conveyor belts. What's the significance of this? You know, how much of a difference is this going to make?
So this is a very significant milestone across the industry. Hundreds of thousands of tonnes of mining tyres and conveyor belts have been getting sent to landfill. For us it's helping us move towards our global commitments around waste minimisation and waste minimisation plans.
What are the conveyor belts actually going to be turned into?
So the conveyor belts, once they're received at the facility, they'll get broken down and they'll be separated where the steel wire that is used for reinforcement is obviously reclaimed, and then the rubber is broken down into crumb. Initially, the tyre and conveyor rubber ends up being used for the same purposes. So that's typical applications such as road construction products, soft sporting and playground surfaces, adhesives and moulded rubber products. And we understand that the bulk of our products are destined for road construction.
Jody Gould is the Regional Environmental Manager for Sustainability at Alcoa, and she was speaking to Amelia Searson about that contract to recycle end-of-life conveyor belts that would have otherwise gone to landfill. 4 minutes to one, we'll head to Mouchet for the results of the sheep and the cattle market in just a moment.
Hello, I'm Annie Guest. Join me for The World Today. Israel agrees to the US President's Gaza peace deal, warning Hamas it must accept the 20-point plan involving a hostage and prisoner swap, but no certain path to statehood. And a celebration of writing at the Prime Minister's Literary Awards, with winners investigating power, privilege and inequality. Those stories and more coming up on The World Today.
It isn't far away at about 3 minutes to one. Well, due to yesterday's public holiday, it was a double-header livestock sale at Mouchet this morning. It was a similar-sized yarding of both the sheep and the cattle to last week. So around 10,500 sheep were penned and 1,500 head of cattle. Terry Birkin, hello. Can you run through all of the figures?
Hi, Melinda. Yes, we had two sales today. Cattle sale first. Numbers were consistent with previous weeks, with quality local cattle in all categories and big lines of pastoral cows and calves. Local weaner steers were selling from 300 cents to 472 cents, while lightweight weaner heifers started from 150 cents up to 412 cents with more cover. Local yearling steers sold from 384 to 440 cents, while yearling heifers returned 208 through to a top of 430 cents, gaining 15 cents a kilo. Pastoral steer calves started from 162 cents up to 400 cents, while pastoral heifers ranged from 134 cents to 378 cents a kilo. Grown steers returned 388 cents to 426 cents, while grown heifers returned 362 to 414 cents a kilo. Store cows made 98 cents to 316 cents, while heavier cows sold from 320 to 356 cents. Heavy bulls were back slightly, selling from 226 cents to 328 cents a kilo. And for the sheep sale, numbers again were consistent. New season store lambs going today, ranging from $100 to $185, while air freight weights sold from $170 to $220 a head. Trade weight lambs were selling from $200 to $257, and heavy lambs returned $240 to $291 a head. Old season store lambs started from $120 up to $166 for bigger frames, while light lambs were selling from $154 to $184. Trade lambs returned $190 to $260, while heavy lambs sold to a top of $320, and a pen of heavy merino ram lambs topped the market at $335 a head. Merino weather hoggets sold from $164 to $202, while merino ewe hoggets were making $170 to $240. Crossbred hoggets ranged from $140 to $250, and younger rams sold to a top of $200 a head. Bone and mutton were making $98 to $172, while medium ewes returned $150 to $220, and heavy ewes topped at $240. Heavy weather sold up to $240 as well, while mature rams sold from $100 to $170. This is Terry Birkin for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Terry, thank you so much. Going through those numbers again, 10,466 sheep were penned, including 4,680 lambs. So that's up 355 on last week. And for the cattle, the yarding was 1,523, and that's up 30 head on last week. Tomorrow we're head to Katanning for the results of the sheep market there. Good to talk to you. News time, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.